amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show, brought to you in association with Trading 212. If you'd like to start investing using the broker that we trust with Stocks and Shares ISAs, there's a link down below to get you started. Use the code FTSE to get yourself a free share. My name's Steve W, and since we were last on air, Tesla shares hit a 52-week low as the company asked investors to sign off on Elon Musk's latest, but not latest, pay deal. Nelson Peltz's bid to win seats on the Disney board was defeated, and Meta Platforms has broken through the $500 mark. But we don't have time to talk about any of those things. There are much more interesting things going on, and to discuss them, I'm joined by Steve D. How are you, Steve? And how has your week been?
Very well, Steve. Yeah, my week's been pretty good, to be honest. Very tiring. Baby's starting to go to bed earlier, and obviously that means that she likes to get up earlier. So there's been a couple of 5 a.m. starts, which, you know, for a new father who only really ever experienced one 5 o'clock in the day unless he was going on holiday, has been quite tricky. Bluey, Steve, Bluey really does seem to get you through those 5 a.m. starts. It's got so many good episodes. It's actually a decent program. You know, when people say that some people used to like the old Disney films because there used to be a little bit in there for everyone. The kids would really enjoy it, but there was jokes in there that only the adults would understand and enjoy. Bluey's a bit like that. So it is quite an enjoyable show that's kind of getting me through at the moment. But yesterday was a real early start and I felt fine all day. And then to my shock this morning, she slept all the way through to my alarm going off. And yeah, I feel worse for it today. I feel worse for having the additional sleep, even though I've had, you know, 11-ish till 7-ish fairly unbroken sleep. So yeah, don't know how that's happened. Don't know how I feel worse. Maybe it was just like yesterday catching up with me, but yeah. But I don't know. Stocks wise, Steve, it's not going very well. I've had one of those weeks where, well, beginning of the year, Steve, everything I touch turned to gold, and it's the opposite of that at the moment. So every piece of gold I touch is turning to lead. So not such a great week for me. Pretty much down across the board on the week. I've got one decent green, which is LVMH after today's the earnings on was it Wednesday night? I can't remember whatever day they came out, but yeah, it showed a little bit of growth. But yeah, I've got plenty of stocks not doing very well at the bottom of the pile, including ones that we'll talk about today, Steve. So yeah, not so bad. Not bothered really. It's part and parcel of being an investor. How has your week been?
Starting with the, yeah, it's not been terrific either, to be honest. I'm trying to work out which I think is a worse feeling. I've sort of felt both over the last, 3 months or so. The feeling of having money sat around and nothing you feel like you really want to buy at any given moment because stocks have been sort of pushing higher and you now think, oh, I don't know, this doesn't feel right. Or the feeling of stocks all hitting the same price that you want to buy them at pretty much together. And you kind of throw your cash into it and you feel like you're kind of fighting a volcano using a fire extinguisher. So now I've got loads of ideas for stuff I want to buy and not a huge amount of cash knocking around. I've got a little bit available to invest, but I've gone from watching it piling up in the Trading 212 account, to be honest, and enjoying my daily push notifications that I'm earning a quid or so in interest. I'm very happy with that. To now thinking I could do with something to add to all of these, having spent them on things that were not really purchases that I kind of regret, to be honest. Just wish I had more of it to throw at things, such as the nature of being anyone other than Berkshire Hathaway, I guess. So yeah, portfolio is down. As usual for me, it's sort of in the, on a down week anyway, it's sort of in the middle of a lot of the indexes. It's worse than some and it's not worse than others. I tend to have a policy of performing roughly in line on the way down and underperforming on the way up. So that's my strategy for making money. It's been, Bluey. Blue is terrific. Every parent says the same thing. It has just enough in there for the adults. My little one's a little bit older than your one. He absolutely loves Bluey. He would sit there most of the day watching Bluey given half a chance. And he doesn't really get half a chance to spend that long watching it, but he will generally have a little bit in a day. He knows what he likes now, and what he likes is Bluey. And, well, Easter egg chocolate, mostly. He's in a bit of a slightly odd stage at the moment. He's closing in on being two, and we're getting visions of what him being two will look like. In the unpleasant way, but he's enjoying scooting right now, which is a good thing. He's pretty good at that. We were away for, which is why we were off the air partly anyway. I was on holiday. We went to Cornwall. It was nice. The weather was not. It was the day that we came back. It's been terrific there this week, apparently. But alas, this week is not the school holidays, so we are back. It's barely the university holidays. I'm back in work. I'm working quite hard. Term starts for teaching on Monday, and I am, as usual, feeling grossly underprepared, but also kind of secure in the knowledge that this is how it always feels. Not much more to add than that, Steve, other than I wouldn't get through all the Bluey stuff too quickly because you'll want to watch it several times over. And so our show descends into discussions discussions of cricket and gardening into discussions of Bluey as people watch our kind of career arc progress together. Enough of that. What else have you been thinking about?
This week watched a really, really good video, which I'm going to recommend to everybody here. It was a video by Patrick Boyle, who we have recommended a number of times. And if you're not subscribed to him on YouTube, why aren't you doing that? But he's put out a video on something you may or may not have known about, but it's called NEOM, or The Line, and it's a linear city being built in Saudi Arabia, or in the process, or in the maybe even thought process of being built in Saudi Arabia. And it's essentially going to be a city that, rather than be roughly circular, it's going to be in one great big line. So the idea was that this thing would be about 170 kilometers long from one side to the other, and they hope that it would have quite a lot of people in it, many millions of people living in it. But now they have scaled down the idea somewhat, and they're going from 170 kilometers to 2.4 kilometers, which is considerably smaller. A smaller scale plan, and they think that rather than 9 million residents are expecting to have in it, they're aiming for a more 300,000-y sort of number. So yeah, big plan, scaled back, very interesting plan, Steve. If you're interested in the idea, I would recommend a little bit of further exploration outside of the topic. But Patrick does a really good job of introducing it, telling you, explaining it to you, and also explaining the change to you as well. So I highly recommend you check it out. It's I want to say it's called End of the Line, but I'm just looking now and it's not. It's called The Rise and Fall of Saudi Arabia's Linear City, which is a shame because I think that's a missed opportunity. But yeah, really recommend it. Really interesting video. And what about you, Steve? What have you had a look at?
Yeah, your name's better, by the way. They should rename this thing. And that's a missed opportunity, as you say. I quite like Patrick Boyle in general, so I might take a look and a listen at this one. I think he's actually genuinely as well, which is always a nice thing. I knew a little bit about this, but I could do with some more digging, I guess. That's the second thing this year, then, to have gone from 170k to 2.4k, the first being my portfolio. No, I'm kidding. Obviously, it was never 170k. Now, I, on the other hand, have been spending part of my time away looking at a bit of writing from The Wolf of Harcourt Street, who is a very good follow on X, if you're interested, if you happen to be on there and interested in kind of write-ups on companies of the kind that we might use in our own research, or maybe if we had the sort of time and energy produce ourselves. It's a similar sort of level of detail. I'd like to think it's a similar sort of level of insight. In honesty, it's probably better in some places and slightly less of what I'm looking for in others. I recommend it. I don't rave about it, but I recommend it. And here's why I'm recommending it to you. I was reading his, I'm pretty sure it's his, report on Mercado Libre recently. So a stock I talked about a few weeks ago where I was thinking, yeah, it's been a while since we looked at that. He's also been having a look and he's got an initial kind of opening investment thesis on it from about a year or so ago and an updated one this time out, which just models out some financial stuff going forward. Uses some ideas from brokers to try and inform this a little bit. Make of it what you will, agree or disagree with the assumptions. Here's why I'm flagging the Wolf of Harcourt Street. People have been nicking his stuff on X and they really ought to stop it. So if you're interested in reading some decent stuff, get it direct from them and don't accept any imitations. I am not keen on people stealing work from others in this case. And if you put in the kind of work that Wolf of Harcourt Street does, think what you like about the quality for the moment. Complain about it if you want. But people ripping it off is really frustrating. I haven't had anyone ripping off my stuff. It's not worth ripping. But if I were in his shoes, I would be cross about it. Pretty sure he is cross about it. So I'm going to give him a shout out here to direct people to the right place for finding his stuff. Steve, you're well familiar with this. I know this because you sent it to me.
Yes, Steve. It's a very good and a very interesting. I think it's a Substack. I'm going to call it a Substack for now. But yeah, really, really worth checking out. Covers a lot of the stocks that we cover. Mercado Libre and Adyen being two that spring to my mind immediately, and always a really good and helpful take and quite thorough take on the reports, and broken down into a way that is quite easy to understand. I've got another sort of one that I could tack on the end of this, and it's on YouTube. I will endeavor to link it, but it's Fede Sandler, who used to work for Mercado Libre. He has done a podcast with the guys from Growth to Value, and that is about South America in general. And they talk about Nubank, I think dLocal, and Mercado Libre, and a couple of others in there as well. And yeah, I recommend checking that out. It was a pretty enjoyable, pretty enjoyable podcast from somebody who is in the space and has worked at Mercado Libre. He's now left. I believe he runs an investment fund now, out in South America. So yeah, really interesting, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Very nice. I mean, if we're bit hacking them on, in that case, I did also listen to the CFO from Mercado Libre talking to the guys at Scottish Mortgage Trust. In whatever the title of their podcast is, I've forgotten it now, and it was really, really good and really, really insightful. But we can come back to that one another day. There's plenty to get through on this show that isn't just things that we've had in sort of double consumption week. So where shall we start, Steve? Shall we start in the US?
Yeah, let's do it.
US is a very sad place at the moment. They are currently losing to the UK. All over the place in the inflation stakes. We've had macroeconomic data out recently, which kind of the US launched theirs first here, and they said the inflation there was starting to creep up slightly. It was at 3.2%. It's gone up to 3.5%. And their unemployment data, which also came out recently, has gone from 3.9% to 3.8%. Which is good or bad depending on how you look at it. Here's the reason. It's good for an obvious reason, right? More people have jobs. Or fewer people are unemployed, more accurately. It's bad for the following reason. Lower unemployment rate is not a positive sign for inflation, and not a positive sign for inflation is not a positive sign for interest rates. And realistically, that's the reason the markets have been falling lately, both in the UK and the US. There's talk that interest rates might not be coming as quickly as people thought they would. It feels like this is a running theme, to be honest, of people being over-optimistic about interest rates. But I will say, even I was starting to get to the point where I thought, okay, it makes sense to start thinking about them with inflation's reached 3.2%. Maybe the hardest bit is the most difficult to get rid of here. But anyway, compare that, by the way, with the UK, who have got their inflation rate down to 3.2% from 3.4%, and their unemployment, they've managed to kick it up to 4.2% from 4%. So probably a stronger incentive for the Bank of England to cut interest rates at the moment. I doubt they will. Suspect they'll stick by their policy of just holding a big sign saying whatever the US just did. But nonetheless, this is the first time in a long time that macroeconomic data from the US has been generally worse than it has from the UK. Why the hell am I talking about this? Well, it's in earnings report season from the States as well. So Wall Street gets to find out what people have been up to for the last quarter or so. Arguably, this season never really kind of stops. We get earnings reports sort of fairly steadily through the year, but it begins traditionally with the banks, and the banks are often thought to be a good indicator of what the economy either has been doing or is going to be doing, which is why I started with that macro stuff. Here's the news from the US banks in no particular order. Wells Fargo reported revenue of 20.86 billion, I think that is, which is plus 0%. Very much 0%, our favourite metric here. Earnings per share were $1.20, which was up 8%. JP Morgan, revenue was up 8%, earnings were $4.44. That needs adjusting slightly because if you compare that to a year ago, that's before they managed to acquire, or I mean, they were kind of given First Republic, but that's currently weighing on their, not weighing on there, but and distorting their year-over-year metrics in a way that we'll come back to in a moment. Group revenue was down 2%, earnings per share were down 27%. That's also because they have a lot of one-off messy costs to do with their restructuring. More on those in a little bit. Goldman Sachs revenue was up 16.3% and earnings per share 28%. Bank of America, which for some reason reports the other side of the weekend to all the others, revenues were roughly flat, I think, and earnings per share were down 15%. They came in at 83 cents that I've written if I can read my own writing. Nah, fine. Interesting across the board. Here's what I thought I'd try and do to shuffle this into something that we can make a bit more sense of. I've tried to pull out some kind of KPIs from across the sector and see what we make of those things. So here's one thing that kind of stood out across the board. Investment banking revenue is coming back. Bank of America's investment banking revenue was up 35%. Wells Fargo's was up 69%. I didn't realize Wells Fargo had much of an investment banking division, but anyway. Goldman's, which I did know had an investment banking division, was up 32%, and J.P. Morgan's was up 24%. Loan volumes, though, were, I think probably the best way of putting it is that they were flat. Bank of America's was up 1%, Wells Fargo's was down 2%. J.P. Morgan's, once you adjust it for all the First Republic stuff, they were up small, basically. 3%. So if you don't include the adjustments of First Republic, it looks like they're up by 16%. They didn't. They were sort of more 3% in a like-for-like, as it were. The other thing that's gone up a lot is charge-offs, which is to say, or net charge-offs, which is to say debts that have gone bad and basically expired, minus anything you've managed to recover from them, which is why it's a net number. So for JP Morgan, that was up 69%, Bank of America it was up 86%, and Wells Fargo was up 105%. So, lots to kind of take in there, Steve, but what of any of this stands out to you?
Charge-offs, so yeah, they're coming through, they sound high when you put them in percentage terms, but it's because they're coming off off results that weren't particularly high to start with, isn't it? So, it's a worrying sign that things are, you know, that charge-offs are getting worse that fast. But when they're starting from fairly low numbers, it's not the major concern, you know, that it is. The loan making is interesting. I think we're seeing that weakness in the car industry from the sort of the car deliveries from pretty much all of the car companies, really. They're all saying a very similar thing, that they've got a build up of inventory and they're finding it hard to shuffle them off, even when people are offering fantastic discounts on them and continually bringing prices down. It's still very difficult to shift cars, so it would be a shock to see loan origination be up, which it isn't. But yeah, investment banking is an interesting one, Steve. They said, I was reading a couple of articles that reckon that it's the beginning of the next wave of IPOs, that the cyclical downturn in that part of the market is coming to an end, and we've had a couple of fairly successful IPOs recently, and they think that that potentially means that, you know, that it's kind of one of those things, isn't it? They're a bit like Lemmings IPOs. They're sort of like, you know, one of them sort of like jumps off the cliff, and if he hits the rock on the way down, they sort of think, well, maybe we won't do that. But then the minute one of them reaches the sea, Steve, they all start jumping off together. And I would expect to see, if the market stays accommodating to them, a lot more IPOs coming shortly. But largely, Steve, I mean, I've not been like, particularly, there's nothing I've read in the last couple of weeks that has really made me think like we're in serious bother here. Do you know what I mean? Everything is trending slightly negative away from, you know, where we had been. But there's nothing really here that makes me think that, you know, we're heading to some massive crash. And that could be this. That could be our career ender there, Steve. That could be the one where, you know, where we didn't see the most obvious, the obvious thing going on. But to say that we had raised, you know, historically low rates as hard and as fast as we had, and yes, that it's fine for people to say, oh, they're not as high as they were in the 80s, but they've been really high for companies that had been basing their business models on them being really low for a long period of time and not stress testing debt levels going up like they have. Resiliency across the world, Steve, as well, not just in America. I mean, Britain to only be in this tiny, tiny minor recession. Europe, only some of the countries have gone into minor recession. America, yes, there's big spending going on in America, which is hiding potentially, you know, less GDP growth. But all of the economies are doing or are being more resilient than I would have expected. And that continues to be my overriding point, Steve. So I don't see any reason for myself why I wouldn't continue to keep putting money into the market. I've got, I've spent all of that money that I put in the first week in April for when the new tax year started. I've got about £900 of it left. So not all of it. And I've got some money due to go in the next week or so that will be invested. Like you, Steve, said earlier, opportunities are coming a bit thick and fast for the low amount of money I've got. I've got to have a think about it, which I really dislike. I like to have a clear idea when the money's going in, where it's going to go. And at the moment, there's this like spread too thin kind of thing going on in my head, which, you know, I'm going to have to get my head around. But yeah, no, nothing in any of these reports, Steve, at the moment that makes me want to, you know, go buy some gold or whatever. Anything jumping out at you?
Nothing makes me want to go and buy some gold. The investment banking revenue, I was going to say, wasn't a surprise. I mean, it's also coming off a low base here, and you've kind of seen the IPOs starting to come through. I think you've seen kind of heating up, or it feels like we've seen kind of heating up, is M&A activity. And with the kind of, as you pointed out, companies that have set themselves up for low interest rates for a while going forward, all of a sudden they need to find a strategy for coping in higher interest rates, and that might be getting acquired. More on that in a bit, or banding together basically to try and boost some economies of scale and get something moving in the right direction here. I'm also not seeing anything that would cause me to think a crash is coming. However, that's not to say I don't think the stock market go down again from here. I mean, what we've seen several quarters now is interest rate cuts receding further and further into the future. And as they do, and as it becomes evident that it's not happening next month, all the money that was kind of on next month rolls off, and it replaces itself with kind of further away, which is negative for stock markets. So there's reason to think, I think, stuff could go lower from this point. Don't mind if it does. It could stay there until I got some meaningful cash to stick in. That would be pretty helpful. And it's not just companies, of course, it's people that are set themselves up to deal with low interest rates and finding these things starting to come through. So it'll be interesting to see how the charge-off ratios work in their way forwards from here. The one that really went down after its earnings was Bank of America, that lost about 5%, although probably worth noting that isn't necessarily at first sight hard to see why, right? Investment banking revenue increase was kind of in the middle. Net interest income was kind of in the middle. pretty much everything it's performed in line with the rest of its sector. But what we've kind of started to see a little bit is interest rates, not interest rates, but bond yields pushed higher on Monday after that, and weighing on a lot of things, including Bank of America. And that's probably the reason that stock has gone lower over the last few. I still own Citigroup. It's still the largest investment in my stocks and shares ISA, to be honest, because part of my Berkshire Hathaway stuff is hidden away in my LISA. They're kind of starting to do this thing they call flattening the curve as part of what they describe as org simplification, which is basically their way of saying selling off a whole load of businesses and sacking a load of people to try and bring their costs down. It's interesting to see how that goes. I think the numbers here are very, very noisy. They were looking at sort of $1.58 in earnings per share. Would have been $1.86 if you ignore the kind of one-off costs, which I don't think you should, to be honest. I don't plan on kind of fact future when they're not a thing anymore, so I don't plan on ignoring them now when they are. But I remain interested in what's going on there, and I'm not buying it right now, but I'm positive on it for the sort of to mid future as far as I can see anyway. Anything more on the banks here, Steve? Or invested in some Goldman Sachs now that investment banking's coming around again? Can't make the case for it as a $15,000 stock.
I mean, Goldman Sachs would be the one that I would be most interested in because I think it's got the most... I mean, JP Morgan is arguably the best of the bunch, but it's priced to be the best of the bunch. And the value in it, even though it has done quite well against market, I'm sure it's a market beater off the top of my head. I'm fairly certain it is over the last decade, quite comfortably. And I'm always perpetually surprised when I log in that it's not $90 anymore. It's more like $180 or something. JP Morgan is priced to be the best. Sachs is overpriced too, I think, considering... where it's been in the cycle. So its cycle it's just coming out of has been probably about as bad as it could have expected for them, but the price hasn't really come down with that kind of part of the cycle. If we were 20-25% lower than where we are today, Sachs would be a really interesting move for me at the present price. It's just not. And out of the others, I mean, I've owned Citibank before, and there was a turnaround when I owned Citibank and it didn't really materialize. To be fair to you, this turnaround actually looks like it's happening, at least insofar as units are being sold, staff numbers are coming down. This is somebody actually trying to make something happen. So I'm really intrigued to see how that one plays out, but I'm more intrigued to see it with your portfolio rather than mine.
Yeah, fair enough. I think if there were one I was going to buy at the moment, and I don't think there is, I think it would be Wells Fargo. As I try and keep an eye on them and see how closer they are to the end of how much closer they are to the end of their asset cap, well, they can't be getting further away from it, and I don't think they are getting further away from it, in all honesty. That said, that stock has roughly doubled from where I first saw it, slightly more. I just saw today, got a notification, it's hit a 52-week high. That's despite being under an asset cap. You've got to start thinking that's kind of priced in a little bit. That they do have quite significant capacity to get bigger and better, but they've got an awful lot to work through before that happens. They have had for a while, but if forced, I'd go that direction. Fortunately, no one is forcing me. So let's shuffle on to something else, shall we, Steve?
Yeah, so ASML reported this week, Steve. The market didn't really like the report. I've gone through the figures here and I've pulled out basically the sort of stuff that we pull out every time we do ASML. And luckily, Olivia slept quite well this evening, so I've been able to do the call as well. And to be fair, I just read the transcript of the call, so I haven't actually listened to it. So hopefully I get some of the inflection correct. But there are some interesting bits and pieces in it, and we'll go through it. Nevertheless, so revenue came in, and these are in euros. Everything's in euros. So 5.3 billion, which was down 22%. Gross profit came in at 2.7 billion, which was down 21%. Net income was 1.2 billion, down 37%. And free cash flow was an outflow of 676 million euros. In terms of their business metrics, they sold 70 units in this quarter, so just like 72, and we would have been we would have been flat year on year. But hey, revenue by segment. So net system sales was 4 billion, which was a drop of 26%. Net services sales was 1.3 billion, which was a drop of 6%. In terms of the order book, they added 3.6 billion in net bookings. 63% of that is logic, 37% of it is memory. And for non-EUV, that was 3.6 billion, and net bookings at EUV was 656 million euros. That leaves you with a total backlog of 36 billion euros. So essentially, ASML have got nearly a year and a half's visibility there, which is quite incredible considering just in the last sort of 3 years, they've doubled their revenue. So to still have that level of backlog is pretty impressive. So in terms of a guide, they said net sales would be about 5.9 to 6.2 billion euros. They reckoned installed base management sales would be about 1.4 billion, and the gross margin had come out somewhere around 50 to 51%. So onto the call. They said that China is looking strong this year, and China is adding capacity because it's what the world needs. And they expect that market share to grow in China, and they have a higher need for self-sufficiency because they're essentially being cut off the higher end products. They said to expect your first 2-nanometer product in 2025. They're obviously seeing some really good progress with that, and there's a quick transition, they think, to what's called GAA, stands for Gate All Round. So I've done a bit of digging on this just to try and give you a really sort of succinct answer of what this is, but it's kind of like the next step in semiconductor design. But it means that the gate wraps around the channel on all four sides. If you imagine like a tube wraps around a wire, and this allows better control of the flow of current. And so one of the issues we have with semiconductors at the moment, and we're talking about Moore's law here and keeping it going, is the smaller and smaller we've made transistors, they get what's known as like a current leakage problem. And having a full gate reduces this leakage and enables basically us to make them smaller and smaller and smaller. But they also can handle more current when you go gate all round, which should mean that we can have faster and more powerful chips. And because we have less leakage going on, you should also get more efficiency. So we should be able to have faster, sort of more powerful chips, but you know, with using less power consumption. So in case battery tech doesn't move on at the same speed, of course. So hopefully that helps you understand why, you know, that's quite an important like step. So they said that they ended Q1 with negative free cash flow, and they said this was primarily driven by a lower down payments received, but also a higher inventory relative to the last quarter. And the higher inventory is a result of increased material intake, including high NA, and this is as part of a planned capacity ramp in preparation for 2025, which, if you remember the last time we covered this, and remember, they've got visibility into this year because of the backlog. They think it's going to be, the terms they didn't use, but the terms I'll use, a stonker. So it means that they're going to build inventory, and they're going to continue to build inventory just to prepare in advance. And obviously because the lead times are so long. They shipped the first high NA EUV to a customer that's under installation. The second one has shipped as well now, and installation on that is starting. They were keen to remind everybody that the backlog is at 36 billion euros with 13 billion of orders in the last 6 months. And they said to just to remind you that orders in ASML, it's not going to be linear. It's a lumpy and zigzag style. But if you imagine it growing from one end to the other, and to expect that essentially. On 2025, they said that it's going to be a very strong year and it's backed by a very strong backlog. They think there's strong secular trends and they're in the middle, will be in the middle of a cyclical upturn in 2025. And there's obviously all of those grant money flying around for new fabs in America. I think there's about 20 odd billion of money gone out to Samsung, TSMC and Intel now. And they were very keen to remind you that ASML, when it comes to EUVs, are the only supplier. And that's why they're confident that orders will come. They said it quite funny. I'll pull this exact quote out. But it said, so I think this is what we've seen before. And we've seen it again. But again, as Roger said earlier, if you believe 2025, and you know that if you want to buy an EUV tool, there's really only one phone number that you can dial. And yeah, I think that is kind of the case. So... 2024, they said, is already fully booked. They're just shipping what is booked. 2024 is going to turn out as per the guide. There's really nothing else they can do about that. They said that they're in the habit of shipping what is booked. So there's little doubt in their mind that 2024 will turn out just the way they gave you as outlook. So that was the ASML call. Stock was down quite a bit on the week, Steve. I think like 7 or 8% off the top of my head. I don't really see anything here. I mean, just to say, I read out a lot of minus numbers here. All of it was bang on guide, really, in terms of revenue, income, and everything else. So for the market to take it badly seemed a strange one to me. Any thoughts?
Yeah, it's a slightly odd thing to be kind of looking at. I get that those numbers were down, and the thing that sort of initially stuck out to me was the negative free cash number. But with a company like ASML, I mean, you know, it's not the case that suddenly they've found a way to sell things for less than their money or something like that, right? It's I wondered whether it might have something to do with timing of paying suppliers or anything along those lines. It's my kind of initial guess, and sort of. So it's an inventory build, basically. And storing inventory can be expensive, but they're guiding, as you said, 50 to 51% gross margins, which is roughly where they are at the moment, with 2.7 on 5.3, so it's just over a half. Doesn't sound like a big inventory build is going to be an issue. We'll get onto inventories in a little bit, and things that really are problems with that kind of thing. But yeah, so booked revenue is kind of low, but kind of expected. And as has always been the case about this thing, I think they've got plenty to be getting on with while they figure out how to drive sales again, or whatever else it is they're sort of planning on doing. As you point out, that's they are roughly limited by the size of their market, and I get everyone's limited by the size of their market, but that is their kind of main limitation. They put it in terms of being the only number that they can call. They don't have competitors to kind of worry about here. What they have to worry about is staying in front. The stuff on Gate All Round is kind of lost on, but it is kind of emblematic of what you want to see from a in a broad semiconductor company. I know it's not strictly chip design and so on, it's machinery, but what you want to be seeing here is companies innovating and continuing to innovate, because this strikes me as a space where you can get a really big lead, but you can also lose a really big lead. I'm not sure how easily ASML could do that, which is one of the reasons I'm not bought this just yet. I'm not entirely certain as to how far that lead will stick around, but they are clearly working hard to stay in front, which is what you have to do in this kind of area, because if you're not moving forward, you die in this sort of sector. So yeah, interesting that they were kind of bang on guide. That's usually a sign of good management, to be honest, understanding that there's cyclicality to this stuff, because you know, semiconductors are cyclical. Don't care what anyone says or has said before, they do everything, but not the kind of stuff that ASML is making equipment to produce doesn't. So in general, what you want from a cyclical company is your management to be able to foresee that and have a good feel for where they are and what's coming down the line. And if they're coming in line with management guidance, that's just the way things are, I think. So I also didn't see anything here to really worry about. Keep working their way through that backlog, and doesn't get too expensive when it comes to storing things. I think probably buying in ahead of an anticipated big ramp, I would take them seriously on that, because they successfully called the kind of downturn for the time being. That's, I guess, the main thought I have here, that this is kind of pretty well run here, and I'm impressed at management calling this correctly.
It's hard to be wrong, isn't it, when you've got so, like, your lead times are so long, because essentially you know how long your machines take to make, you know how long they take to install, and if you've got 18 months worth of backlog, you can kind of know what you're going to ship between now and 12 months time, so it must make forecasting a lot easier than, you know, than say a SaaS company or something like that for ASML. But one of the other things I think people are kind of missing is that last quarter was a record in net bookings per quarter. They brought in $9.2 billion in bookings, and just to compare it to the quarter before that, or the quarter before that, it was $4.5 billion, $2.6, $9.2, and then $3.6. Mm. So what I think we had was, you know, some excitement in the bookings for Q4 in full year 23, and this is back to a somewhat of a normalization. So yeah, we're in a cyclical downtrend. They think this is quite short-lived. They think by the end of this year we'll be going back into the sort of like mega books for ASML. And remember, at the end of last year they told you this year was going to be a flat year for everything. You know, not to expect much growth, and the growth was to come in 2025. And when a company's got 18 months of visibility, you shouldn't be shocked by anything that they bring out. In terms of the dividend, Steve, because I know you want to know that, they said that they're going to bring the dividend up to €6.10 per share, which is about a 5.2% increase over last year. So there's been three payments of €1.45, so you're going to get a €1.75 payment to round you off. And just to let you know as well, there are buybacks still going on at the moment. ASML purchased about €400 million worth of shares in the quarter. They buy these pretty indiscriminately throughout the year, regardless of price. That continues. A little bit of capital return, and I didn't really see anything here to be particularly worried about, to be honest.
No, I was trying to look out what that dividend yield was. It's sort of about 0.75%, if I'm right there. And then when you said 5, I was like, it's never a 5% yield on ASML. You were going to say 5% increase, which is where you're going on that. That plus share buybacks makes this worth looking at, I think. There's sort of not just a growth story. It's a company with kind of genuinely excess cash because they are currently investing hard into their R&D on top of it. That could be quite a powerful combination.
Agree. What have you got for us?
So the next thing I've got is a less powerful combination. It's Doc Martens that we've been looking at. And I've been kind of sort of taken with this, but in what I guess is an introduction to the world of value investing to you, Steve, it turns out that if you find things that have attractively low PE ratios and so on and so forth, and quite good balance sheets and intelligent looking management, there's a sign there's trouble around the corner. Market's not as stupid as you might think it is. Stock fell 29% week to, or it was basically, at least, I suppose we should call it the latest all-time low. This stock does nearly nothing other than make all-time lows as far as I can tell. So they issued a kind of update where they said that over the next 12 months, they're expecting sales to fall. Overall, their sales to fall in the sort of high single digit range. They're expecting the US sales to fall in the double digit range. Looking at a sort of 20 million hit to profits, I think that might be 20 million profits hit, and 35 million in cost pressures, as their inability to sell boots means they have to store them. And they are not busy buying in excess inventory ahead of a massive ramp. They are busy stuck with inventory that they can't shift. If that reminds you of any other companies we've talked about recently, I couldn't possibly comment on the subject. But look, having excess inventory isn't a good thing if you don't have the demand for it. What particular part of the what sector you're in, although I think mostly it happens in the kind of discretionary sector where you have to try and manage this. The other news, or at least part of the other news, is that CEO Kenny Wilson is stepping down, is in charge. He's being replaced by Nwokari, who is their chief brand officer. Apologies for absolutely making a mess of his name. That ought not to be broadcast ever. It's tempting to think then that since Doc Martens has been public for about four of those 6 years and all it's done is go down, that Kenny Wilson has been a chronic failure of a CEO, and pretty much it seems to enjoy issuing profit warnings at a rate that's really quite alarming for its investors. I guess just on the CEO for a moment, I would sound a note of caution in thinking it has been a total failure. I was looking back over this company and the business, because if for the moment you think, well, look, it IPO'd fairly recently, and it's not his problem what price it IPO's at. If it IPO's too high, that ain't really to do with him or his fault. People want to buy it off private equity at a ludicrous valuation. Not his job to tell them not to. So leave aside for the moment the movements in the price and have a look at what the business is doing. I mean, revenues have gone from 349 million to about a billion in the last 6 years. That's pretty good. Profits have gone from 40 million to 191 million. Earnings per share have gone from losing 1p to 13p profit per share. That's after kind of peaking in 2022 and starting to slide down in 2023. And look, it's clearly going lower again this year. But I'm sort of wary of the lazy idea of saying that stock price is that guy's legacy, and it is basically down and to the right and continuing to go down. With this one, I think I'm have a mixed view on the subject. I'm reasonably positive on Doc Martens still, and I like it at a lower price more than I like it at a higher one, even if it was already at quite a low price in the first place. I'm mindful that I thought the company was doing smart stuff before when it was buying back its stock at what looked like a reasonable price. To me, that looked like an intelligent management decision. They say, and I kind of believe them, that demand will snap back as the US recovers. They just don't know when that's going to be, and they're not expecting that to be this year. So they're expecting another year in the wilderness. If this turns out to be just part of a larger kind of cyclical headwind, then maybe. But where I'm really worried is whether this goes all for time, which is to say, it turns out to have done something, in this case, launching a big e-commerce warehousing operation versus opening a new factory, at what turns out to be almost exactly the wrong moment. I have some sympathy with this. In the case of Doc Martens, this could be the right long-term thing to have done. In the case of Forterra, I mean, you have to open new factories when you got the money to do it. But if this starts blowing holes in the balance sheet, and their balance sheet is all right, to be honest, at least going into this, then I would start to worry, like I'm worrying about Forterra, to be honest with you. But there's been a good amount of pop recently on takeover. Some of their kind of activist insiders was saying they need a strategic rethink. It's no longer in shareholder interest for this to be a public company. They're not getting value for money. Should sell it, or should consider selling it. And I don't really want that to happen very much. I'd rather buy it myself than sell it to someone for what I think will probably be a bargain. But then again, I'm a bit more patient than these guys are, and I'm not being assessed in the way that they are either. So maybe if I was in their shoes, I'd think that too. That's pretty much where I got to on Doc Martens. I'm very wary to see that next update come out, and I want to see what's happening with that balance sheet, because if the thing is taken on water and it's starting to knock holes in itself, then I'm going to start worrying. I saw someone on Trading 212 saying, well, look, if they can keep paying the dividend and they can keep managing their debt, I think there is absolutely no way they keep paying their dividend at their current level. If they do, it's an absolute steal. I think the reason it's an absolute steal is because I can't see how they will. Steve?
No, it would be ridiculous to keep the dividend, really. Profit is expecting to come in about a third of the level that it did last year. So to keep this dividend would be ludicrous. I would expect the dividend yield to follow the profit and maybe even get cut altogether. Couple of things to note, really. This company, when it IPO'd, it IPO'd at about 380p. So its balance sheet was shored up by a pretty good raise. In fact, it could have raised even more, because it shot up to about 500p within a couple of days. So that is that they've not been affected by this. This is not a balance sheet decay issue here. This is a bit of a botched launch in America kind of problem. One of the really interesting things to sort of point out, Steve, is that we're at about 650 million in market cap at the moment, down from the I think it was 3.8 billion it was at one point. Permira, when they bought this out, private equity, paid about 350 million for it at the time. So we're not a million miles away from Permira probably taking a look at this and going again, maybe we could buy this, hold on to it for 5 years and spin it out for 3.8 billion again. It is a company that seems to do a lot better when it's outside of the public eye. Maybe that's an option for somebody. I'm still on that that kind of it needs to be bought by Deckers kind of idea. But somebody also pointed out that Kering might be a decent home for it as a premium brand to shuffle into that pile of brands, a decent home for them. And the beauty of something like LVMH or Kering, which LVMH I think is less likely, but Kering may be more likely owning them, is they would quite quickly repatriate all of the manufacturing process, because one of the reasons why you pay so much for designer brand gear is it's very often made in France, and the manufacturing is you know, well-paid people, highly trained people making, you know, low-run amounts of items for you. And that was one of the beauties of Dot Martens, is that they were always made in Britain. There was a lot of care and attention in the detail and in the making of them. And in shipping that manufacturing off to Asia, one of the big concerns that I had about the stock, and one of the things I've got my eye on, is people complaining about the quality of the boot. And they have been complaining about the quality for a while. Those complaints went away in the last sort of 18 months, and if they start creeping back, then I think we have a bit of an issue. But overall, this is just a stock selling a premium good, trading like all the other stocks selling premium goods. For whatever reason at the moment, premium goods are not in the limelight. They're not selling as well as they were. And I don't really think there's anything more to it than Steve. I don't think we need to think about this one too hard. I think it's kind of attractive here, and there's a potential that this is one of the ones that I add to.
Yeah, the a profit warning is never a good thing, and I feel like the market, and maybe this is justified a little bit, reacts worse when it's your eighth profit warning in 5 years or whatever it's been for Doc Martens now, which is maybe justified, right? I mean, certainly some of them were genuine management failings. They were launches. And that makes investors less patient when you start saying, now we're under cyclical pressure as well. Even if that's not really anything that Doc Martens can do anything about. That's just where they find themselves. Interestingly, I wrote up the idea of Doc Martens being acquired by Deckers as a Motley Fool piece. No one was interested in that. They were very interested, however, in my idea that Burberry might be getting acquired by one of the kind of major French fashion houses. I didn't particularly worry about the idea that they don't want to get shipped across the channel like that, but they're also having a tough time of things, and it's much more complicated than just saying they sell a lot in China and China's been a mess lately. They have deeper problems than that too, because LVMH sell a lot in China and they're doing fine. They've also had issues with Chinese lack of demand, but nothing like what Burberry's been facing. So interesting times. We're gradually seeing the FTSE 100, 250, in some cases 100, and taken out in installments. There's that M&A activity we were talking about again. So that's, I suppose, one to keep an eye on if you like looking at acquisition potential. Doc Martens feels like one candidate. Burberry kind of feels like another one, to me, to be honest. But time is slightly against us here, Steve. Shall we talk about another UK thing?
Yeah, so I've got some quick notes on Wise here for everybody. Wise, again, this is just a trading update, so there's not a lot of information in it, but I've got as much of it out as I can and tried to make sense of it. Again, Wise, the way it reports things are like really, it's really irritating, because they use words like income when they mean total revenue. And that makes it really, really difficult for us to get it. So I've changed some of the headings, and hopefully it makes a little bit more sense to you. But I will I'll try and emphasize bits when I can. So here we go. So financials, these are all year on year. So volume was 30.6 billion. Sorry, these are in pounds as well. So volume 30.6 billion, which is up 14%. Revenue was 277 million. That's up 24%. Other revenue was 104 million, up 86%. Income, which again, if you add revenue and other revenue together, 277,104. Income was 381 million, which is up 36%. Again, that is revenue and other revenue. So think of it as total revenue or something like that. Customer acquisition costs crept up 2 basis points to 67 basis points. Instant transfer usage was up 62%. So full year revenue, and this is because it was Q4 24 for them, full year revenue came in at 1.052 billion, which was up 24%. And full year 24 income came in at 1.4 billion, up 46%. So again, that's revenue and other revenue added together to make income. And again, some of this is higher interest income on customer balances, and other income is generally things like the Wise card, interchange, what have you. So customers, there was 7.895 million, up 29%, 7.5 million personal, 395 business, personal up 30%, business up 16%. In terms of volume per customer, now this is a bit where I think where we lost some of the share price. So total was 3.9k volume per customer, which was actually down 11%. Personal was 3k, down 11%. Business was 20.3k, and that was down 5%. So potentially there's a slippage in customer quality there, but also potentially not. Total volume was 30.6 billion, up 14%. 22.6 billion of that was personal, up 16%. 8 billion of it was business, up 10%. On-platform balance quarter-on-quarter was up 3% to 13.3 billion. This is just money that people hold in Wise. And in terms of segment revenues, it was total 277.2 million, up 24%, which was personal 250 million, up 24%, business 62.2%, 62.2 million, up 24%, and again income 381 million, up 36%, personal 276 million, up 36%, business was 106 million, up 38%. Interest income net of customer benefits grew by 86% year on year to 104 million in Q4, full year 24. And in terms of revenue take rate, that was up 1 basis point to 91 basis points. Cross-border was 67 basis points, which was flat. And the Wise card was 24 basis points, which is actually plus 7 basis points. So full year 24 income growth was ahead of expectations and contributing to an exceptional level of profitability. And they said for full year 24, the growth in customers using Wise combined with the higher rate environment has driven income growth by about 46%, higher than their expectation, which they thought would be between 42 and 44%. And with an elevated level of interest income being retained and lower levels of transactional costs, their gross margin is actually going to be higher in the second half of full year 24 than the 74% that was in the first half of full year 24. As a consequence, adjusted EBITDA margins will remain exceptionally elevated relative to their midterm guidance, which they think will be more at around and above the sort of 20% mark. Christo Klarman said, "This quarter, we resumed business customer onboarding across the vast majority of Europe, and we continued to invest in our infrastructure and broaden our offering around the world. In Asia alone, we became one of the first international financial services to be granted a Type 1 funds provider license in Japan. They've added Standard Chartered's Mox as a new platform banking partner in Hong Kong. And they've expanded their partnership with Tiger Brokers in Singapore, which now facilitates card issuance in Singapore. So you should start to see you should see other revenue continue to grow. It looked pretty good to me, Steve. I had a person reach out to me on Trading 212 and say, you know, are you exceptionally worried about this report? And the really frank, honest answer with it is, I don't know why we're down 10% on the week or whatever it is. I might even be more than that now. It might be more like 12 to 15% on the week. I don't really think there's much in this report that I need to worry about at all. Steve?
Down 17 on the week. Actually, interestingly, it started the week at roughly the level it IPO'd at way back when. And after its IPO, it had a little bit of a pop and then fell away quite sharply. It IPO'd at not a tremendous time, I think, for It was sort of 2021, so maybe kind of peak time, and got a bit of a push, and then things fell away quite a bit. So we're down to about 17% below the IPO price, but the IPO price is quite a long time ago, to be honest. It's been a lot lower than that in between. So what you're looking at here, I guess, is I tried to find out what other people were saying about why this is down, and I suppose there's two views you might kind of take. One is that if you zoom out on the kind of price chart, it's not down by an awful lot in the grand scheme of things. Actually, 17% after what is really quite a long rally that's seen it more than double from kind of mid 2022. So over the last, let's call it 2 years for rounding, the thing has roughly doubled. That's still a mighty fine response, even if you give back 17%. So maybe there's sort of a little bit just coming off there. The guys at Shares Magazine made some points that I thought, they really struggle with wires, I think. And that's not to criticise them. That's to say this is a challenging thing that's not particularly their area of expertise. And they made kind of points that I thought were fair, but also pretty clearly not the answer as to why this thing might be going down. And they've done this a couple of times now. So they pointed to reasonably high interest coming from balances on customer accounts, which won't hang around forever, that kind of return. That's probably true and fair. They also pointed out that in general, this is certainly by UK standards, quite an expensive stock at about 38 or times earnings at the moment. Both those things I think are true. Both those things I think are fair. Both of those are reasons why I might go downwards. But you didn't find out those in an earnings update. You didn't realize that interest rates aren't going to be high forever because of what Wise said in their latest update. And you didn't realize that it turns out it's at quite a high PE. You weren't expecting to find it was at a PE of 9 and it's suddenly become 30 or something like that. So look, I'm not too critical of they're looking for a solution and coming up with one that I don't think is terribly plausible. I don't have a better one myself, so it sort of behoves me to not really criticise in quite the same way. I don't think they're right, and I don't really know quite why I think this has come down a bit. The main thing I guess I take away is that if you zoom this out, it's not a big drop in the grand scheme of things.
I think it's a criminally underloved business in the UK, to be honest with you, Steve. That's my main takeaway from Wise. I think this is our... and I wouldn't have said this when we were looking at things like Monzo and Starling and Revolut and companies like that, but I actually think this is our sort of gold standard fintech at the moment. This is a company that has seen in the opportunity and grasped it. So to see it doing well... is, you know, and then being punished for not really doing anything really wrong, it's kind of sad to see. And it is another one of these companies that you think perhaps if this was on the American markets, perhaps it would be doing even better than it is today. But I don't see any reason for it to move just yet. I think this is another one, Steve, that I'm going to stick on the list of things I should probably be taking advantage of a 17% dip on. It probably goes on the list with Doc Martens. And to be fair, Hortons was on it because that had a fair collapse. But today I noted its report was fairly strong and probably something we should cover in the next couple of weeks. I've got a stock to pitch as well, Steve, at some point in the future. I've just got to write the stock pitch on it. But yeah, got plenty to come.
Yeah, I've got one that I've been having a look at, and there's a real danger it's going to hit the level I want to buy it at. It sort of feels strange to be waiting for something to do that whilst everything around it appears to be on fire. But we'll talk about those in future weeks. I did wonder whether you might make the point about UK listed companies attracting lower multiples than their kind of US counterparts. You probably heard this week one of the latest to join the kind of potential shift things abroad movement is Shell, which is the largest company in the FTSE 100, sort of think they could do better somewhere else. They might be right about that. If I was a Shell shareholder, though, I would be pursuing that line, or wouldn't be mad keen to see them pursue that line. Shell is a company that has focused quite heavily on shareholder returns via dividends and buybacks, and I think they would do better to just keep buying their stock back at low prices and and enjoying their time while they do it, in contrast to sort of BP, who have been attempting to invest in a kind of greenish infrastructure and wind farms and finding that's a real challenge when prices keep going up and so does the cost and you try and borrow this thing and it makes your share price go down. Anyway, back on the subject of Wise, yeah, really interesting business, differentiated kind of thing. It's a strange one because it ought to be, it's growing really impressively and yet somehow still goes on radar, which is maybe, I guess, potentially a feature of it being listed in the UK. That's it's not the place you go to look for fast-growing, impressive businesses, at least not naturally. That's not to say that they do exist. Wise is one, and I think there are others too. But it's, yeah, a tricky sort of issue for... it's hard to work out what's going on with Wise, and no one I've seen has any real kind of sense as to why that stock has been falling quite so sharply. Okay, in that case, we will leave things for this week. It's nice to be back and talking about stuff. We've got plenty more for next week as well. Stocks to talk about further down the pipeline, but we're in the middle of earnings, and I think Netflix has probably reported while we've been on air recording this Thursday the 18th here. I can see Steve probably Googling that at the moment, so I'm going to guess it's put out a pretty... No, okay, fair enough. Okay. Well, anyway, that brings us to the end of our show. A reminder that if you would like to sign up with the brokerage that we use, Trading 212, there is a link down below. Use the code FTSE to let them know that we sent you. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.